on 105 FM and around the world online. This is FM 105, your local station, live from the heart of Downpatrick.
Welcome along to the Chris Scott Show on FM 105 Down Community Radio. I'll be here for the next hour. A cram show tonight for your ears only. Started the programme there with one from all the way back to 1956. Yes, 1956. Well before my time, I'd add. That was Hound Dog by Elvis Presley, released on that very day in that year. Later on this month, of course, we'll be remembering the 44th anniversary of his passing, which took place on the 16th of August 1977. Where does the time go? Tonight we have the final installment in the first series of The Adventures of Jonathan, no middle name Jackson. That's performed by the Castlewellan Studio Players, and it's episode 12, so stay tuned for that one. Also tonight in the Chatting with Chris feature, I'll be speaking with Margaret Drake, originally from the Guildford area and now residing at Cricklewood Farm in Crossgar. Margaret is a poet and author of children's books, and if you want to hear more about Trolioli, hopefully I've said that right, Margaret, and Eckle Cackle, I think that's the way it's said, then you're going to have to stay tuned. Margaret will also read some of her poems tonight with a local theme as well. And I first set eyes on those poems at the Sir Hans Sloane Centre in Killaloe, in Main Street in Killaloe, where they had on display a poetry exhibition. Our Beautiful Loch and Maiden Voyage are two of those poems which you're going to hear all about later on, about trips out across Strangford Loch and beyond. Talking of Strangford Loch and the area, you may recall a few weeks ago I spoke to local singer-songwriter Conal Montgomery, or Conal Montgomery, he knows what I mean, Conal's from Killaloe, and he was telling us about a new song he was recording. So tonight, for your ears only, we're going to be listening to The Shores of Killaloe. Absolutely beautiful rendition of this song. It was originally written as a poem by Father Liam Vaughan, who served as a curate in Killaloe here between 1966 and 1969. Well, without further ado, here is the finished product. And after we hear this one from Conal, we're going to be chatting with Margaret Drake. Stay tuned, it's FM 105 Down Community Radio.
Chatting with Chris on FM 105 Down Community Radio. Your station, your voice.
Joining me tonight, it's Margaret Drake, and you may ask, who is Margaret Drake? Well, I'm sitting in the Crossgar area tonight. I'm at a farm called Cricklewood Farm, isn't that right, Margaret?
That's correct, yes.
And Margaret, listen, thank you so much for inviting me around tonight. I first came across you in the Sir Hans Sloane Centre, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? And you had a couple of poems on display there, and I just thought, wow, they're wonderful. And then in walked Margaret, and I said, do you know what? You have such an interesting story. So we're going to, I could take you back to the beginning, Margaret, but we'll just talk about the poems that you have displayed in the Sir Hans Sloane Centre. One called Our Beautiful Loch and one called The Maiden Voice. I assume it has something to do with this area.
It is. It's about Strangford Loch and my experiences on it.
But you just don't write a poem. You just don't go out in the loch and write a poem, Margaret. There must be a history here. You're an author, and I know looking around the walls here, you're an author, you're a poet. You're involved with children's books at the minute. I mean, I don't know how you get the time, but where did it all start?
Oh, years ago, I've always wrote poetry over the years and stuff, you know, but it's only the past 5 years that I've started on the children's books from I moved here to Cricklewood Farm. And then the character Trolioli, he's been around for a good while through me and my children, you know. He actually started off as a scary character. If the misbehaved Trolioli's going to get you if you don't behave yourself, you know. It's the same as the character Eckle Cackle in the second book. She's the witch.
So there's not one book, there's not two books. I think you said there's three books. Now, I am looking at behind your desk here, and Trolioli is staring out at me, and I don't even know how to describe. It's like a little green character with ear-like horns, a red T-shirt, his belly's hanging out. I think that would scare any kid. How did you ever come up with that idea?
I honestly don't know. It just happened. And see his belly button? He's got a knight and an eye below the belly button that he can see in the dark, you know? Okay. So in the story, he's down in a well that's pitch black and the rabbit's with him and the rabbit says he's got 20/20 vision because he eats carrots and he can't see nothing. And Trolioli says, it's okay, I'll open my night vision eye and he can see where they're going. And takes him safely up to Mollioli, his cousin, mm-hmm. who they're away to visit.
Was that how you based the first book then, around that character?
Yes, definitely, yes. And the characters in it are animals that they would come across on the farm. You know, there's Tea Leaf the magpie as well, and Ramble the Rabbit and Buttercup the Cow on the Trampoline.
For listeners here, I have to describe those. There's some beautiful portraits of these characters on the wall here. But I take it you wrote the story first and then handed that to an illustrator.
I did, yes. Desi B, he wants to be known as. He's my illustrator. So he read the story and went by the description of the character, and then he brought him to life for me, and I was delighted, you know, with the result of it. I couldn't believe it. So he's framed up on the wall to stay.
So the next stage really is probably going to publication, which is probably easier said than done, Margaret,
yes.
I would think.
Yes, it is. Especially over here, I feel that the publishers here don't do enough for the local people. You know, they're interested as long as there's history in it. But, you know, something like this, my characters are from this area. The book's from this area, but it's still not enough for, you know, the publishers over here to take on. So you're having to contact England or America. And because you're not well known as a writer, they want you to put money forward in case they lose out, you know, after the publication and the sales and stuff. But we'll just have to wait and see. Somebody will turn up somewhere, I'm sure.
So these books have been tried and tested on grandkids, I assume?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What do they think, Margaret?
Well, some of them listen and some of them don't. It depends on their age, really, you know. The younger ones get fed up after the first couple of verses and that's it. They're away, like, you know. But, yeah. But, like I say, the characters and a lot of the stuff that I've wrote and all the kids have grown up with them, especially Ackle Cackle the Witch. Like, at Halloween time, I build Ackle Cackle and she stands in my kitchen in the corner, right? It's a mask I bought when my children were very small. And it actually pulls down over your head. And it's her and all. And it's all the big nose and all this. And I put it on a tripod or, you know, and put the trousers on, the boots on and the coat and all on her. And she stands there for a couple of weeks and they see the Ackle Cackle and they're like, hi, Ackle Cackle and all. And then on Halloween night, the decorations are up and the thunder and lightning machine's on. And my daughter, she's ready to work it. And while they're outside watching the fireworks, my daughter-in-law, Christine, she's small, so she comes in and she puts the mask on and the clothes on and she takes the pose with the broomstick. And then I say a spell. I have it wrote up there on the wall, actually. Mm-hmm. On this night I call to thee, move your limbs, your eyes will see. Walk this earth for a little while, but you can't walk more than a mile. Thunder roar and lightning strike, eat a child if you like. Ackle cackle, rise for me, let us count, 1, 2, 3. So when I say thunder roar and lightning strike, Figgy puts on the machine and then Christine starts to move. Yes. And my youngest granddaughter, Sophie, scream that loud. I'm surprised they didn't send for the police from Cross Garth, which was making. But it was all good fun, you know. And my ones, they grew up with that character in their life and, you know, they just loved it.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's not all about scaring kids, Margaret. Mm. I mean, I'm looking here. There's a book on your desk here, From Guildford to the
Aurora Borealis.
Aurora Borealis. I'm so glad you said that. I mean, this is something that you've self-published and it's a poetry book.
Yeah.
And Guildford is obviously very close to your heart.
Yes. I was born reared in Guildford. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the poem. The very first poem in the book is about Guildford. And it's Guildford as I remember. Now, my uncle, Winford, and my dad, Melvin, I actually wrote with special thanks to Mr. Melvin Drake and Dad in brackets. And Mr. Winford Drake, uncle in brackets. Will I read it?
Yes, we'd love to hear it.
Guildford as I remember. Guildford was founded by a military man, McGill's bridge that crossed the Ban. Through this little village which sits Banside, let's take a walk and I'll be your guide. The wall road has its claim to fame, the black wood where the soldiers came. To their barracks entered through doors of blue, our guardians, defenders of World War II. Back past Gertie's, we shopped there for years, Fox's pub on the corner with spirits and beers. Across the bridge, Crozier's Butchers we see, a pork chop, veggie roll, something nice for tea. Eileen and Roger Moffat's shop next door, with newspapers, cigarettes and sweets galore. Sawyer's fruit shop by the entry that ran down to the race, bruised apples for free, brought a smile to our face. Walking now past some houses towards the square, Irene's sweet shop she ran from her little wheelchair. Public toilets for anyone, but you had to be brave, for black were the walls as dark as a cave. British Legion was next Todd's store, then a bench, outside the library framed by a fence. Let's rest for a while and take in the view. I'll try to name all the shops for you. Sinton's Chemist, some houses, then Robinson's Pub. There's the bus stop, the Undertaker's and the Pigeon Club. Julian's Hairdressers for a haircut. McCleary's Chip Shop next door. Then Frank and Joe Murphy's grocery store. Moving on round the corner, Lackey's Secondhand Store, with furniture, bric-a-brac and loads to explore. Kane's Haberdashery, where Mum bought her wool, also buttons and ribbons and threads on a spool. Treacle Farrell's soda bread, cream buns and jam tarts, Lackey's Bakery a favourite in everyone's hearts. Gough's newsagents, a butcher with a shoe shop next door, a credit union for the whole village with a great rapport. Across the street, the back entrance to our school, through big iron gates, 9 o'clock was the rule. Lulu Pentland, a teacher, P4 was her class, lived there in a cottage and watched as we'd pass. Dunbarton Street takes us past houses then hearts. For furniture and household he sold all the parts. More houses then a church, Free Presbyterian its name. Kyle Paisley, the minister, Ian's son was his fame. Next door on the corner, Freddie McElroy's store, where Mum bought her uniforms, our socks and much more. Then Jack Neal, who fixed gates and such stuff, the men in the village called him Harland and Bluff. That's us back through the square and up Mill Street again, a post office and Moody's, Jean and Eddie by name. Everett Nelson's shop with cobbler on his sign, Sammy Sweden's a garage with grapes on a vine. An old-fashioned shop with a bell on the door, Ken McElroy whistling while mopping the floor. Murphy's Pub on the corner if you fancied a beer, a war memorial with a service held each year. Three churches, two castles, two parks and a mill. No graveyard as stated in McMaster's last will. As you read through my poem, maybe you'll remember the same. I hope you enjoy it. By the way, Margaret Drake is my name.
That is brilliant, Margaret. That is so good. I mean, Guildford County Down is the other side of County Down.
Yeah.
And that's going back to an era when you were wee. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, like, you know, over 50 years back.
Yeah, but you know, you may not think, but you've recorded that for posterity because, you know, in 50 years' time, people will read that and go, wow, you know, we didn't know all those places exist. I mean, the names of Crozier, they're still there. You know, some of those local names, Pentlands, that, you know, people like that, you know, are still about that area. So, I mean, when did you write that?
Well, it's well over 5 years back now, mm-hmm. you know, and when I got the wee collection put together, I took up something like 10 or 20 books up to Guildford, and it was actually my father that sold most of them for me, you know, and I got a great response from the people around, you know, and especially people that's moved away, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
Saying that brought back lovely memories and what have you, and then they would comment and say they remember something slightly different or, you know,
mm-hmm. yeah,
but that's their my memories, you know,
yeah.
they're different, I suppose, to some old people's, but.
So going back further to school days, I mean, early school days, I mean, did you write as a child? Did you write much?
Well, not really, but I loved reading. And I dedicated the back of this book to the teacher, you know, my primary school teacher. She would like to make a special mention to Mrs. Vera Bodell, her primary school teacher, who introduced her to the written word as a small child, thus installing the foundations to her writing career. Because it was Mrs. Bodell in Guildford Primary School that taught me to read.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so I took her a copy of the book out and gave it to her, and she was delighted.
Yeah.
You know, and she's a good age, you know, but she's lovely. She was always lovely, you know, one of these teachers that always kept herself nice and, you know, and she's still like that.
So as you grew up and then got into, I'm going to call it big school because some of us went different ways in life, but when you got to big school, were you still writing? I mean, did you write poems even at that stage?
Well, we had a teacher, Mr. Elkin, the English teacher, and sometimes he would give us homework. And I remember that some of my friends in my classroom used to give me a half pence to write their homework for them. So, and then they would say to me, make sure yours is extra long, because then by the time he read it, there wasn't very much more, you know, a lot of time left for to give us extra homework or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so I suppose I really did like writing all my life, you know.
And any of the poems I've been looking at tonight, they're very featured about the area, you know, the area that you've lived in. And there's one you put in front of me here about Belfast Zoological Gardens. What an interesting poem. And you showed me a couple of photographs of an elephant on the wall. I think that's something to do with the Second World War, whenever the zoo was being closed down at that stage. But what an amazing poem. I mean, why did you write that?
Just reading the story, and I think it was in a newspaper article or something one day, and it just inspired me to go into it. I would go in and get all the, you know, the information and make sure it's right and make sure the dates are right and stuff, and then rewrite the way I look at it, but the way I would see it, you know, about her. And it was so interesting, and parts of it was funny what she did, because I had to walk her from the boat up through Belfast, you know, up the Antrim Road to the zoo, and the things that happened to her on the way and stuff.
I think you'd also told me that in your lifetime that you judged a children's poetry competition in around the Belfast area.
Right.
How did you get involved in that?
Again, it was actually through this book, because my father was speaking to a neighbour of his, and she worked in the place down in Belfast, and she contacted me through email and asked me would I like to, you know, be a judge at a children's competition they were holding, you know, so that's how my daughter came with me. That was an experience, you know. So.
Chatting with Chris on FM 105, Down Community Radio. Your station, your voice.
We'll be joining up again with Margaret Drake from Crossgar after this one, which I'll play for Pam Wright. Pam is over there in Canada and made contact during the week, and she tunes into the station on a regular basis. So thank you so much, Pam. Great to have listeners all across the world, especially in Canada. I hope you're going to enjoy this one. It's What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong.
Chatting with Chris on FM 105, Down Community Radio. Your station, your voice.
I'm looking around me in your office here, and it is like an office, but you are in, I'm going to say, the middle of nowhere, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it must be so inspirational in the countryside. I could see you getting up in the morning, there's maybe a few rabbits running past the window, and you could just sit here and write all day. Is that what you do?
Sometimes. It depends really on my health, you know, but the good thing about writing is you can lie down and write. If you're, you know, if I'm unable to sit up, I can lie down and write, or you can even dictate, you know. And my daughter would sometimes write the thing for me if I had to get her, you know. But, yeah. But I find it's different things, you know, out and about. Maybe, you know, you'd read something and think, oh, that sounds interesting, and inspire you to look into it more and maybe write a poem about it, you know.
So the two poems that I had first set my eyes on in the Killalea, or down in Killalea in the Sir Hans Sloane Centre, the first one was Our Beautiful Loch. And that's very local to here. So you're not from this area originally, but you must have been inspired going out onto that loch.
Yes, I was, definitely. I've been on the loch, you know, for, I don't know, a lot of years anyway. But the One Hour Beautiful Loch, I was inspired by, the, you know, it's such a beautiful place. It's just, you know, you're in the middle of the loch and you look around. And then I just said one night, I'm going to write it as I'm looking off the deck of the boat.
Yeah.
You know, and around the whole area of the loch.
And for anybody who hasn't been in Strangford, I only experienced this very recently. I finally got out on a boat. It's a totally different perspective from what us looking from the land out, isn't it?
You're right, it is. And it can be scary sometimes as well.
Yeah. And
the dangerous place. Yeah, you're right.
Margaret, do you mind reading this one to us?
Fine, that's okay, yeah. Our Beautiful Loch. The treacherous waters called the Bar Mouth, with Strangford sitting on the shores to the south. Up the narrows with currents travelling each way, the town rock a marker that shows Killalea. Donny Neil with his cap on, wild fowl in his hand, white horses break against the brown sand. Shrigley's chimney amidst the green hills, a remnant that's left from our old flax mills. Ring Hattie, my favourite, Lady Mags is our boat. The bay protects her like an old raincoat. Up the sound at a speed that's measured in knots takes you into White Rock, the home for the yachts. Daft Eddies and Castle, the rose and the thorn, as we cruise around the island into Ballydorn. With the lightship anchored to the seabed, you can't miss her splendour as she's dressed all in red. Passing Cumber, Long Island, our Durport in sight, Scrabble Towers, Red Beacon, warning planes in their flight. Next we come to Mount Stuart, the gasworks in view, with the Temple of the Winds peering down at you. Cruising by Grey Abbey, then Kirkcubbin, that's all. Once again in the Narrows, Portaferry, last call. Sea breezes whisper, caressing my face. Oh, Strangford, your waters are such a glorious place.
Margaret, that's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And having been on that side of it, I can recognise, especially the chimney. You know, if I'm driving on land, I know I'm nearly home. Or if I'm looking out to sea, you know where you are.
Yeah, that's true, that's true.
And the other poem then, what inspired this one, Maiden Voyage, then? How did all that come about?
Well, this is from the very first voyage that I went with my late partner to the Isle of Man. And we were following a larger boat. And this is actual fact. I wrote this, you know, a few weeks after we come home. I swore never do it again, but I did it twice after that again, so I'm sort of like a glutton for punishment. It's titled Maiden Voyage. Engine starts, first turn of the key, throw off the ropes and set her free. Radio check, 5 knots the speed, trivial pursuit she'll take the lead. Leaving Ring Hattie Sound past Limestone Rock, the Narrows, Portaferry, we're leaving the lock. Portside, large turbine, starboard Kilcleef, out front is the steps we're crossing the reef. A bearing is taken, stern lined with the buoy, 110 degrees southeast to deploy. Our convoy's destination, Peel Harbour, Isle of Man, 3 hours for the journey, Belfast Coast Guard knows the plan. Halfway through our journey, a message by phone, our lead boat had to leave us, so we proceeded alone. Fuel running low while darkness descends, only 3 nautical miles to our journey's end. Lady Mag's Ring Hattie distress call was made. Coast Guard took details, the message relayed. A loud bang from the shore signalled the crew. A lifeboat was launched, Lady Mag's their pursue. Bright lights from the lifeboat turned night into day. Tying our bow to their stern, we were towed to the bay. Tethered to a fishing boat, a safety check took place. We were safe for the night, outer harbour our first base. Next morning, after refuelling, instructions were relayed, proceeding through the floodgate to the inner harbour where we stayed. The lifeguards came and told us the bangs we heard last night were from a cannon which was fired to tell them off our plight. The Coast Guard is a service any sailor will agree. Without their help, how many souls would perish in the sea? The Isle of Man was beautiful. I'd like to go again. But do not worry on my behalf, for I'm taking the bloody plane.
That's brilliant. And do you know, anybody who sails will know, a lot of that I wouldn't get because I don't know a lot about boats, but do you know what? It is factual. I get that, yeah. Mm-hmm. A nice little twist at the end.
Yes, yes, definitely. But like I say, I must be a glutton for punishment for I did twice, 2 more times after that. So,
yeah.
But I think that'll do me.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Can I ask, and maybe you don't want to give this away, but what are you working on now?
At the minute, I'm doing a wee piece on Killaloe, but the history is so vast, it's unbelievable, you know. You could write about 10 books on the place, you know. I've just finished writing a bedtime story. It's like a nonsense poem, really, to my grandson, Spencer. I started off telling him this wee story going to bed, and then he wanted this story every night that he goes to bed by two heads. It's the two-headed man, call it, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm going to see what happens with that.
So you've started that, and you have a wee bit more development than that one?
Yes, and then hopefully I'll send it off to a publisher and see what happens.
That's brilliant. Mm-hmm.
So there must be somewhere in this desk, and don't need to say it, but I'm sure there's a box full of lines just waiting to be finished and put together somewhere. Most writers have that.
Several boxes over there and over here.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, do you ever actually go back through those boxes and have a look at sometimes, some of the stuff?
Yeah, sometimes if somebody would talk about something and maybe, you know, trigger a memory and I'd think, oh, I know something about that, but my memory's really bad, you see, so I would have to go and refresh it all the time anyway, you know, so at least I've got that there to fall back on, so to speak, you know.
And what do the family think?
I think, well, my daughter and, my daughters and my sons and all said that they're very proud of me, you know.
Yeah.
But I think they think I'm a wee bit crazy anyway, you know, so I suppose that helps, like, you know. And you mention Ackle Cackle or, you know, they go, ooh, you know, but they love it.
Yes.
Yeah, they love it.
Yeah.
Their favourite time's Halloween.
Yeah, okay.
I love the summer and the heat and all, you know, for it's very good for my health, but they absolutely love Halloween.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And Christmas, like, you know.
So can we expect to see any more characters jumping out of the woodwork this Halloween?
Well, you never know.
Well, listen, if you do, give us first shout, because we always like to put together a Halloween special. We've done that last year and spoke to Gawn up in the castle, and he told us the story of the ghost there.
Oh.
So I leave that on your desk tonight, and I'll talk to you again on Halloween.
Right, that'd be lovely.
Margaret, can I thank you so much for joining us tonight, and do keep in touch, and any poems, send them in, and we'll get you to read them out for us.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for having me. Yes. Amazing.
Chatting with Chris on FM 105 Down Community Radio. Your station, your voice.
Thank you so much to Margaret Drake, poet and author there from Crossgar. Great to catch up with what she's doing. Hopefully she can join me later on in the year. Love to chat to her about all those Halloween antics again at that appropriate time. So coming up after the next one, or the next single, the next disc, the next song, whatever you want to call it, we'll be joined by the Castle Welland Studio Players in the 12th and final episode in the first series of Jonathan No Middle Name Jackson, so stay tuned for that. This one's by Wet Wet Wet. Love is all around, and this is for Veronique Murray. I hope I've said your first name right. She's just outside Downpatrick, moved recently into our area, and has recently only discovered that we do have a local radio station, and you're listening to it right now, so I want you to enjoy this one.
You're listening to Chris Scott on FM 105, Down Community Radio.
Another episode of The Amazing Adventures of Jonathan, No Middle Name, Jackson. Last week, after using the cream of the Japanese magician Son Tan Lojian to avoid being damaged by the harmful rays, the swirly whirly thing transported Jonathan, Samantha, and Donna back to 1971, where they emerged at the far end of a field in Somerset.
Jonathan, do you remember back in episode 10? When I said I was worried that we seemed to be rather slow in collecting these items.
Yes.
Well, this is the last episode, and we are only halfway through the list. What are we going to do?
I really have no idea, Samantha.
Should we ask the writer?
He's as much in the dark as we are.
Has anyone else noticed that the good jokes have all dried up?
There were good jokes. When?
Bit harsh, Samantha. They're not being that bad.
I think the listeners might disagree.
So where do we go now?
Jonathan, what do the instructions on the jar say to do?
I'm having trouble reading them.
Let me try.
I don't think that will do any good.
Why? Because it's 1971 and only a man can read instructions?
No, because I dropped it in the swirly-whirly thing. It's anyone's guess where it is now.
So now we are stuck here with no idea where to go next.
We could go to the other end of the field. There appears to be a music festival happening.
Not sure how that will help.
I think the writer's hoping for inspiration when we get there.
While the writer desperately tries to come up with a storyline, Jonathan, Samantha and Donna cross to the other side of the field and join a large group of scantily clad people sitting on the grass listening to the music, who offer them food and drink.
Jonathan, did you notice that the woman who offered you a bottle of water was topless?
Possibly.
And did you notice what was written on her waist in black marker pen?
I never got that far, I'm afraid.
It said, "For information on the treasure, see behind."
Behind what?
There's an extremely muscular-looking, very well-toned, naked man walking past. And look how he is holding that pint of beer.
That's novel. I have never seen it done that way before.
I know. You would think it would slip off.
Well, it is very thick, so it's probably well-balanced.
And long. At least a foot, I would say.
Maybe even longer.
I wonder if he brought that stick with him or just found it on the grass.
There's writing on his backside. It says, "Find the Whistler."
Samantha and Donna continue to study the man as he walks away to make sure they have read the message correctly, until eventually they can no longer see him, even after standing on tiptoe. At that point, the three of them head towards the stage area to look for the Whistler. Samantha agrees to meet a very handsome, long, curly-haired guitarist who has a strange glow about him backstage in order to get the location of the Whistler.
Samantha, you're finally back. You've been gone for hours. I was getting worried. Did the guitarist give it to you?
Yes, Jonathan. Twice.
So what did he say?
The weird thing is that the guitarist vanished before my eyes as I was talking to him. But before he went, he said that the Whistler is in one of the tents or caravans in the next field. But he did not know which one.
There are hundreds. It could take us days to check all of them.
Luckily, we have the glass of water, which has the ability to let its user see through solid objects.
Haven't the listeners already been told that?
Yes, but that was back in episode 8. I'd be surprised if any of them managed to remember its special power by the end of that sketch, let alone 4 episodes later.
But how will we know what he looks like?
Look for a man with a large object on the top of his head. That's what Jimmy the guitarist said.
After an hour or so of searching, Jonathan, Samantha and Donna are sitting in a caravan with the Whistler, a man so-called because he whistles when he speaks, a man that has a story to tell.
Not another story.
Yes, another story. And one the writer himself finds hard to believe, even as he's writing it. It all started 1 year ago to this very day. There I was in my local pub with my band, Tin Whistle at the Ready, for my big solo part, when suddenly, above my head, a big swirly-whirly thing materialised, and a jar fell out of it and got fused to my head. At the exact same moment, I swallowed my tin whistle, and it got fused to my throat. The swirly-whirly thing vanished, and I was left as you see me now.
Well, that story is actually quite mild compared to some of the previous ones.
Wait, no, there's more.
Of course there is.
By using 2 mirrors, and after days of trying, I was able to read the label on the jar. On it were directions to the artifact, which, at great peril to myself, I managed to retrieve. Also, in the small print, it said, "If lost, please return to Jonathan, no middle name Jackson, Glastonbury, 1971. So I made the journey here.
Just one quick question.
Yes.
Why didn't you get someone else to read the jar for you? It would have been easier and saved time.
Anyway, as I was saying, I made the journey here and I've been waiting to give you these.
What are they?
A special gravity-defying and lava-resistant pair of boots. They were designed and made by the incredibly brilliant Welsh-German engineer and scientist of Native American descent, Ifishu Fitz.
Do we need them for this episode?
No, they're needed for the next series. Episode 1, I think. Or was it episode 2?
Do you have any idea what happens now?
Not for you lot, but my part's finished. So I'm off to audition for the narrator's part in the next series.
Sorry, what?
They're holding auditions for the next series. so I thought I'd have a go.
Yeah, but you said that you were going to try for the narrator's part.
That's right. But to be honest, I probably won't get it. If the rumours are true, some woman by the name of Caroline has her name on it.
But I'm the narrator. They can't change me. It wouldn't be the same. People would complain.
Don't shoot the messenger, mate. All I know is that the auditions start tomorrow and every part's up for grabs.
What do you mean, every part? Surely not mine or Samantha's. We started the whole thing off. Without us, there'd be no show.
Every part's what I was told. But hey, maybe I'm mistaken and you two are okay.
Just to remind you both that I have been in it from the start as well.
What about me? They've already changed you once. Not hard to do it again.
That bloody writer. I told him I had another job lined up if he didn't need me for the next series. But he said I was definitely in it, so I didn't take it up.
Right, well, I'm not needed anymore, so I'm off. Hope things work out. Bye.
Hang on. Who has the eye of Kia?
I do. Why?
We can use it to look into the next series.
Good idea.
What do you see, Samantha?
Nothing. There's nothing there.
There must be something. I spoke to the writer last week, and he told me he has the first four episodes already written.
Well, if he does, he must have them well hidden, because I can't see them.
Quick, let's look through the script to the end. That might give us some idea who is still in it.
That's not really going to help. The characters will be in it regardless of who plays them.
Of course, wasn't thinking.
Let's just carry on with this episode. If we all give it our best, then the writer will see that it will be a mistake to replace us.
Good idea. Whose line is it?
Not mine. I have nothing on my page after the Whistler says goodbye.
Me neither.
Mine's the same. What about you, narrator? What's your next line?
You guys aren't going to like this.
Like what?
Join us later in the year for the next series of The Amazing Adventures of Jonathan, no middle name, Jackson.
In that episode, Mark made an upbeat played the narrator, Michelle Dorans played Samantha Smallwood, Anthony McFadden played Jonathan Jackson, Siobhan Miller played Donna the Druid, with Harry Mitchell playing the Whistler. The writer was Anthony McFadden.
On 105 FM and around the world online, this is FM 105. Your local station, live from the heart of Downpatrick.
Yes, you did hear it right. There is a second series coming up later in the year. A massive thank you, I can't thank them enough, to the cast of the Castlewell and Studio Players and their writers Anthony McFadden and Harry Mitchell. What a service they have provided. All those guys are so talented, and it's great to give them a platform here on local community radio. They're all taking a well-earned break for the foreseeable future, and I'm looking forward to having them on board with me later on the year. Thank you so much, guys. Two in a row now, easing you into a Wednesday night. Different version of The Whiter Shade of Pale, originally by Procol Harum, if you remember that one from years and years and years ago. I don't even know what year it was, but this is one of my favourite versions. It's Michael Bolton, and I'm going to follow that with Phil Collins and Against All Odds. You've tuned in to the Chris Scott Show on FM 105 Down Community Radio. That's it again for tonight, folks. Thank you for lending me your ears and supporting your local community radio station, FM 105 Down Community Radio. Keep the dial tuned there. Have a look at the programme schedule on our website and Facebook page if you want any more details of all the other programmes. Great programmes and great presenters here. All local. Thank you again to Margaret Drake and also to the Castle Welland Studio Players for their input. I greatly appreciate it. Honestly, I really do. Next week on my show, Chris Scott Show, tune in to hear local singer-songwriter from Downpatrick, Lucy Bell. She chats with me about her work to date, and she is such a lovely girl with so much talent, and we're going to hear some of her songs next week.